In Washington County, it's 86 in Beaver County, 81 outside our weather window in downtown McKeesport, 83 street level at the corner of Forbes and Morwood in Oakland at WRCT. Camp Crush from the new album Up All Night, going to take us to news time. McKeesport, Pennsylvania, garden spot of Yohogania. You can find me at jthurbershow.com or on Mastodon, Blue Sky, and Facebook at Jay Thurber Show. Coming up after the news, we're talking the Blues Brothers with author Daniel DeVizet. You're tuned to Freeform Radio from Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh, and Tube City Online Radio in McKeesport. The news is next. It's 1 o'clock.
Story News in Washington, I'm Tony Waterman. The FBI has raided the home of President Trump's former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, with whom he has a contentious relationship. Federal agents swarmed Bolton's Maryland home around 7 Friday morning, reportedly carrying out a court-authorized search for classified documents as part of a national security investigation. President Trump said he didn't know about the raid until he saw it on TV.
You have to do what you have to do. I don't want to know about it. It's not necessary. I could know about it. I could be the one starting it. I'm actually the chief law enforcement officer.
Bolton served in Trump's first administration, but has since become one of the president's most vocal critics. The DOJ sued Bolton in 2020, claiming his tell-all book on the inner workings of the Trump administration included classified information. The case was later dropped. The chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve has hinted that a central bank rate cut could be coming as soon as next month and said the effects of the president's trade war are now clearly visible. The speech was billed as perhaps the most important of Jerome Powell's career, following months of attack by Donald Trump for not cutting interest rates fast enough. FSN's Mitch McCann reports.
It was the strongest hint yet that the Federal Reserve may be willing to cut interest rates, with Jerome Powell telling the audience the shifting balance of risks may warrant adjusting our policy stance. The risk Powell is referring to is a slowdown in the U.S. job market.
The stability of the unemployment rate and other labor market measures allows us to proceed carefully as we consider changes to our policy stance.
The suggestion of a possible cut may indicate that concerns over the labor market are beginning to outweigh worries about inflation, despite Powell's long-standing stance that rates would not be lowered until inflation edged closer to the Fed's 2% target.
Famine has been confirmed in parts of Gaza for the first time, according to United Nations-backed agency. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Analysis says more than 500,000 people are facing famine. Aid agencies fear a military offensive in Gaza City will worsen the humanitarian situation. FSN's William Denslow reports from Brussels.
More than 100 organizations, including Oxfam and Médecins Sans Frontières, have penned a letter calling on Israel to stop weaponizing aid. Now a report from the UN-backed IPC warns that over 500,000 people in the Palestinian enclave are facing catastrophic conditions and face starvation, destitution and death. Israel has described this new report as a Hamas lie and blames it for preventing aid from reaching civilians.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
You don't have to look at pictures on the radio. It doesn't ruin your vision like a TV show.
Practice yoga on the ground or get up and walk around.
You can do it when you're listening to the radio. You can shave or wash your hair while our show is on the air. You can cook up a fondue and we'd still be coming through. You can stay in bed and you'll find we don't care at all. Just as long as you keep listening to the radio. Smoking reefer on the radio while we're really eating cookies and you never know.
We could tell you we look great when we're really overweight.
You can get away with so much on the radio.
Call and tell them what you look like on the radio. Cause if they never see you, then they'll never know.
Doesn't matter if you have acne,
cause they'll never know exactly
what you look like when they listen to the radio. R-A-D-I-O.
Not television.
R-A-D-I-O.
Wearing blunders.
R-A-D-I-O.
All vacuum cleaners.
R-A-D-I-O.
You get the picture?
Coming to ya,
I know there are a lot of Gen Xers who listen to this show. You may have been introduced to the kind of rhythm and blues that I play through a little movie called The Blues Brothers, and I thought I was somewhat unique in that. It turns out that the Blues Brothers movie, while some at the time accused it of cultural appropriation, really reinvigorated the careers of a lot of artists, including Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, and John Lee Hooker, many, many others who were not only touched but very pleased to be included in that movie, which is just celebrating. I can't believe that movie is 45 years old. Daniel Devizet has done a masterful job in a new book that's called The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Film Classic. It is new from Grove Press, and he is on the line with us right now. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon to you.
First of all, I want to say something, and this is not to blow smoke at you, but I have read Dave Thomas's book on SCTV. There have been other books on Second City. I've read the Hill and Winograd book about Saturday Night that came out maybe 30 years ago now. Podcasts, interviews with all these different folks, and I still learned a lot from this book. It is a really good story, but it's also a really masterful set of research. So congratulations on this. Tell me, or tell the audience, I guess, how you got interested in writing a book about the movie and the phenomenon in the 1970s that was the Blues Brothers.
Yeah, well, thank you for that praise. You know, I think it's true with a lot of my books that, well, I've written five of them, and there's always some stuff in there that's kind of well trodden terrain where there's been a bunch of other good books that have kind of talked about similar stuff, and there's always some stuff that hasn't really gotten written about so much, and that's kind of more interesting. Like in the case of this book, the deep dive on the making of the film The Blues Brothers, that's the main thing that hadn't really been told, and you know, most of those people hadn't been interviewed before. But yeah, anyway, why I did it is a very easy answer. I was doing a book about B.B. King. I did a big, like, 500-page biography of B.B. King all through the second half of the teens, finished it up during the pandemic, the peak of the pandemic. And so I was talking to John Landis. I called John Landis because I wanted to know why B.B. King wasn't in the Blues Brothers. You know, he's the king of the blues, so why was he not in that film? And I found John Landis, and I got him on the phone and asked him. And he said the reason was that B.B. King actually was fairly busy at that. And out of all the great rhythm and blues icons, BB had a, I can say this as his biographer, he had kind of a resurgence at the end of every decade. So at the end of the 70s, going into the 80s, he was on kind of an upswing. Mm-hmm. The others who were, the ones who were in the movie, were struggling more than BB was. Anyway, so John Landis got to, he's a great.
And I want to interrupt you there, because we're going to get to that in a second, but it is amazing to me to think that there was a time when Ray Charles's career was struggling. It's amazing to me to think that there was a time when Aretha Franklin's career was struggling.
Well, I don't know how old you are. You're probably younger than me, but I remember the late 70s. It was a brutal time for anyone who wasn't a disco artist or like an arena rocker like Kiss or AC/DC or Journey. If you weren't either that column A or column B disco, you know, you were nowhere in the last couple of years of the 70s. It was a brutal time. You know, the Stones did disco, resorted to disco. Rod Stewart resorted to, all your favorite artists resorted to disco. Pink Floyd, you know, Another Brick in the Wall is sort of a disco song, you know.
Well, I heard about the fella you've been dancing with all over the neighborhood. So why didn't you ask me, baby? Didn't you think I could? Well, I know that the boogaloo is out of sight, but the shingling's a thing tonight. But if that was you and me, I'd have, baby, I would have shown you how to do it right. Do it right. Do it right. Do it right.
Charles et al. Were struggling. Everyone was struggling, but they were struggling even more because they weren't anywhere near either of those two islands, the Disco Island or the Arena Rock Island. And so they were having it. And also, if you go back that far back, they didn't have the exalted stature that they have today. People didn't think of Aretha as the greatest singer in the history of everything, basically, or Ray Charles or James Brown as the absolute apex of the rhythm and blues sort of movement post-war. Back then, they were just, I mean, they were great, but people didn't set them apart the way they do now, if that makes any sense.
Well, you mentioned, and you allude to this in the book, but you mentioned the Steely Dan song, Hey 19, that's Aretha Franklin. She don't remember the Queen of Soul. The
Queen of Soul.
That again, that lyric, it never dawned on me until I read your book that, yeah, okay, there was a time when these artists did need to be rediscovered. And Dan Aykroyd, through the sheer force of will and persistence, really helped them be re-recognized. The book is called The Blues Brothers. Daniel Devizé, am I pronouncing that correctly, Dan? I'm sorry.
That's as close as I'm going to get it. I don't speak French either.
Okay, Daniel Devizé is the author. He's the author of four other books, including King of the Blues, The Comeback, Andy and Dawn, and I Forgot to Remember. You can get the books through his website at danieldevizé.com or bookshop.org, which is where I got mine. It's available from Grove Press. So you talked to John Landis. You talked to Dan Aykroyd and Judy Jacqueline Belushi gave you time. Who were some of the primary sources that you went back to and did deep dive interviews with?
I got to most of the people I wanted to interview. Now, there's an important caveat here, which is in Hollywood speak, it's hard to get people from a project like the Blues Brothers to talk for a book if it's kind of like an ongoing concern. Mm-hmm. The Blues Brothers is a branded thing. And so when I approached them at the beginning, I want to do this book. It's my own book. It's an independent journalistic thing. But they basically decided that unless I was going to make it an official Blues Brothers branded piece of merchandise, it's a great brand. They're great people. Yeah. But that's the way they think in Hollywood.
Sure.
That otherwise they weren't going to, quote, attach themselves, close quote, to the project. And so officially, I wasn't talking to any, Jim Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, Judy Belushi, any of them. Now, what ended up happening was, I was able to interview Aykroyd. I begged and pleaded, and Landis got involved, and I did interview him, and then I was in touch with him, so we were able to check facts, like how many kilometers was it to your grammar school, you know, in
the
Ottawa.
Detail about Dan Aykroyd growing up, and again, I've read some of the other books about the Second City and SCTV and SNL, but the detail about Dan Aykroyd growing up in Ottawa is wonderful. It's hilarious. It's almost a movie in itself.
It is, and there's so little known about him relative to Belushi, certainly in the States, probably in Canada, too. I've heard this from Canadians. And so almost everybody else who's still alive, who's important in this book, almost everybody else I did talk to, I wasn't able to get like Steve Martin, you know, but I got most of the people from Second City who were in Second City with either Aykroyd or Belushi. They both were in Second City in different places. I got some of the Lampoon people who were involved with Belushi, Lemmings, you know, and then some SNL people. I did not speak to Lorne Michaels. I would have loved to, but it's very, very hard to get an interview with that guy. But basically, you can think of it in terms of the bigger they are, the harder it is to get to interview them for a mid-market book like mine. So anybody who's not super, Dave Thomas, God bless him, he's famous, but he's not like, I don't know, Steve Martin famous. And so he talked to me several times. He was wonderful. The late, great Joe Flaherty talked to me several times.
Pittsburgh's own Joe Flaherty, we always call him.
Pittsburgh's own. Yeah. And people told me that Flaherty would not give me the time of day, but I think I somehow got him on the phone, and it turned out we both had bad movie nights we were doing on Friday nights. Him with his brother, Paul Flaherty, and me with my buddies from high school. And so we got to talking about bad movies, and soon we were recommending bad movies to each other.
Well, I would have loved to have talked to Joe, even though he was from Pittsburgh. I never got a chance to, I never got through to Joe either. So talk a little bit about the roots of the Blues Brothers in improv, because that's one of the subtitles of the book is the rise of improv. And you go into a little bit of the heartache that was getting a Second City established in Toronto.
So I should explain. I set out to do a book that was kind of two different things. It was a book about this film, right, The Blues Brothers, but it was also a book about the Blues Brothers, the dudes. Mm-hmm. It was a dual biography, and I wanted to tell the story of the both of them and then have them intertwine and intersect and tell the story of their friendship. So I started in the beginning. Come on, baby, don't you wanna go? really similar upbringings. Both Aykroyd and Belushi came up through Second City. Belushi was part of the kind of reinvention of Second City in Chicago that happened in the late 60s. They'd been this kind of, you know, jacket and tie, real creamed set.
I think of Paul Dooley when I think of that early Second City.
Alan Arkin, yeah. I think Alan Alda.
Very buttoned down.
Joan Rivers, yeah. All these amazing people. But it became a
community theater group, an improv group.
More like Steve Allen-esque, if you will.
Yeah, or
Bob Newhart-esque, yeah. I guess. And then it evolved, and it was the end of the 60s. Chicago was very hippie, lefty, anti-war. So a bunch of 20-somethings and 20-year-olds basically took over with, you know, wide lapels. Harold Ramis was actually the resident hippie before Belushi arrived, and then Belushi kind of became the resident hippie. So that's Belushi. And then so he and Harold Ramis were two big names who came out of that era. And then Billy Murray was right after that, and Brian Murray. And then up in Toronto, you had arguably, possibly the greatest Second City troupe ever assembled in the history of anything, which, it was John Candy, and I was just reviewing a John Candy biography that just came out. Dan Aykroyd, friggin' Gilda Radner.
Yeah.
And then the Schitt's Creek guys, that's Schitt, yeah. Mm-hmm. The man and the woman who were in that show. And I mean, it was an amazing, yeah. amazing troupe.
Yeah, you got Gene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, yeah. Paul Schaefer was kind of floating around with that group of folks, Rick Moranis, I think, came in as a disc jockey. But yes.
These were people who were in that. There was a circle of friends around the Godspell production in Toronto. And some of them weren't in Second City, but they were all friends, like all eight of them who wound up taking over comedy.
Dave Thomas, who comes in, I think, from the advertising
world, yeah.
Daniel DuVizet is the author of The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic. You talk about Aykroyd and Belushi and their childhoods. I did not, even though I read the Bob Woodward Wired book many years ago, I have not gone back to it, but I did not remember just how much his family struggled, especially his dad in the early years. Talk about the Belushi growing up and his family growing up.
I get the sense there was kind of a darkness emanating from the daddy Belushi. He was, and his family who were from Albania, right? Am I getting that wrong?
Yep.
And they were from there, and they were the models for the cheeseburger routine on SNL, by the way. Belushi's family, along with Father Guido Sarducci, who actually wrote that sketch. That writer, Guido Sarducci, was the one who actually wrote the sketch. But anyway, so the father was kind of distant and aloof, and I picture him being gone all week, like sleeping in the upstairs of the restaurant he was running. And then he'd come back home to Wheaton, which was this dry suburb about way outside of Chicago, kind of an exurb, and kind of not exactly knocking heads, but sort of inflicting order on the household and asserting himself. And the mom, I think, was like a Peter Pan sort of never grow up. And she was, they both were kind of like overgrown children and weren't very parental.
She was a little bit of a stage mom as well. She had a career or was pursuing community theater.
She had aspirations.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that she ever actually acted, but she wanted to do that. And so the parents were not maybe the best. And I think John counseled Jim Belushi at one point, you know, you got to get out of this house, get out of this family. It wasn't like they were being, I don't think, beaten or anything, but it was not the best milieu. And so John Belushi, the other thing that was hard for him was he was like the only like ethnic, quote unquote, ethnic person in Wheaton, probably. Wheaton was very, I think, very lily white bread WASP. And Belushi's like dark, you know, olive toned. And so he struggled at school. And I think that's where he got this great personality was he had to win people over, having this unusual name and people not knowing if he was from Italy or what. And so he developed this really magnetic personality. And he was a gridiron great in high school. He was a football star, a jock. He actually turned in the quarterback for drinking beer, which is about the most ironic thing you're going to hear.
he was a jock. He was the class clown, but also, you know, he was a very, very Catholic family. So they were a little bit straight arrow. And like you said, his dad was a little bit of a disciplinarian.
Radio 9! I got everything I need, almost. I got everything I need, almost. But I don't got you, and you're the thing I need.
got into hippie politics and the anti-war movement. He got tear gassed, you know, at 68 at the convention in Chicago, and grew his hair out and became a thespian and got into theater.
And did some straight acting for a while for some different communities.
As did Aykroyd. Yeah. Both of them separately got into serious theater and thence into funny theater. And both of them revealed a great talent for improv and for being funny, you know. And Belushi operated like this three-man little troupe that was like a little sort of knockoff of Second City. And I think it was for an audience of one, and the one would have been the person who hired people to Second City. Belushi just wanted her to come see them, Joyce Sloan, come here, see them perform. They were on the UIC campus, University of Illinois, Chicago, and just like, hey, come see us. You know, so he started his own troupe so that he could get into Second City.
Daniel DeVizet is joining us this hour. He is on the line with us from Washington, D.C. In the meantime, Aykroyd is in Ottawa. Where he's kind of, I don't want to say his family is prominent, but his dad was a well-placed civil servant.
Yeah, right.
There was some money. Certainly weren't struggling. I think he went to Catholic high school, too, or to a religious...
Aykroyd was in actually a sort of a priest preparatory school, like a priest mill, you know, and it was very, very austere. And I interviewed some of his classmates, and he was, of course, rebellious and got in all sorts of trouble there. And they finally sort of showed him the door. And then he went to a less austere Catholic school after that. But that informs a lot of, like, the Blues Brothers is a Catholic film.
Yeah.
And that's because of Aykroyd. Aykroyd wrote it, and he had all sorts of Catholic baggage in his head.
I did not realize it, and I grew up Catholic and went to Catholic high school, but I did not realize you mentioned in here that it is actually a film that is recommended by whatever the Catholic Board of Censors is. They have as it as a recommended film. I did not realize that. Talk about the music that Aykroyd was listening to, because while Belushi is actually playing in a band and he's listening to a lot of punk rock and garage rock, what's Aykroyd listening to up in Canada?
And I should mention, I think our new Pope is a fan of this film, by the way.
I believe you are correct.
Aykroyd fell into this kind of rhythm and blues scene in Ottawa. Ottawa had a very international music scene. There were these coffee houses, and you know, he saw Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker and all these different blues artists. And then Aykroyd himself, he learned the drums and he also learned the harmonica. And he would basically try to insinuate his way on stage with different, not with Muddy Waters, although he played very, very briefly played the drums with Muddy Waters when Muddy was kind of taunting his own drummer who had gone out for a drink or was flirting with somebody. So he said, who here can play the drums?
And Aykroyd came up and played about from Canada comes up
and eight film. Bars. Yeah. And then the drummer came running back and probably threatened him.
Yeah.
So he left. But anyway, so Aykroyd was a shambolic figure in a trench coat and would talk his way on stage with various local bands in Ottawa. So he was a huge blues hound. He saw Sam and Dave perform at the Montreal World's Fair, which I think was in 1967.
Yep, Expo 67, yeah, sure.
Yeah, very, very knowledgeable in the blues by the time he met Belushi, which would have been, only about 6 years later, around 1973.
How did these two meet? How did Aykroyd and Belushi actually meet?
It's a storied meeting. Belushi was he'd gone from Second City to National Lampoon. He performed in Lemmings, the big Woodstocks send-up. Older people will remember this. Mm-hmm. And then after that, he was doing
National...
It was
a very popular album that I think is back in print now, is National Lampoon.
And it was a national... Yeah. There was a national radio show.
Yeah.
So Belushi was recruiting, and he made a recruiting trip up to Toronto, which is where, you know, all the Second City guys were in that satellite operation. And I think he had his eyes on Gilda and on Aykroyd, maybe after seeing them perform. Gilda did join Lampoon and defected to Lampoon. And then she went from there to Saturday Night Live. And Aykroyd did not defect, but he met Belushi one night. Aykroyd, at about age 21, ran a speakeasy on a major street in Toronto. And it was one of these because the bars had to close at a kind of unnaturally early hour. And so the Second City people would retreat to the speakeasy that Aykroyd and a couple of his buddies ran.
You make the point, and I think Hill and Weinegrad make this in their Saturday Night book that came out however many years ago, that Aykroyd's dream would have been to be a Mountie and a bank robber, that he would have robbed the bank and then arrested himself
himself.
That he really had this fascination with the underworld and with crime, but also with Law and Order. You talk about some of the skits that he did at Second City where, you know, if they needed anybody to rattle off technical information. Dan Aykroyd was your man because he could memorize just pages and pages of technical information. I think you also make the point that I had not seen made before, but makes a lot of sense, that he may be somewhere on the autism spectrum, what we would say now.
Yeah, a little spectrum-y.
Yeah.
And he cataloged in his head all these different
cop cars
armaments.
And weapons and badges, yeah. And uniforms.
And then I think that even though he was from a very sturdily sort of middle class, upper middle class, like the kind of family you'd have in Washington, not rich, yeah. But very comfortable.
Civil service, yeah.
But at the speakeasy, he would entertain off-duty cops and really connected with them, really could be the everyman. And, the sort of blue-collar Toronto people loved him. And that was true, probably remains true to this day. He's very earthy, a very earthy guy.
Ideas for this were kind of percolating for years, that Aykroyd was picking up little pieces. There are things in the movie, The Blues Brothers, that Aykroyd was picking up. What were some of the things that he was picking up along the way?
Aykroyd, as I say, was into the blues from the beginning. When he and Belushi met, and I believe it was in 73, that very night they were talking about forming a band together, when it turned out they both were kind of frustrated musicians, you know, who turned to performing.
Conan O'Brien has made the point that all comedians are frustrated musicians and all musicians are frustrated comedians. And I don't know if that's
probably
true or
so.
Not, but I have noticed that myself, too.
And so by the time that Saturday Night Live began in 1975, they were both sufficiently enamored of the idea that they started doing these little musical bits with the warm-up, you know, when the audience mm-hmm. is there before they start taping. And they developed a little blues act, because probably Aykroyd was sort of leading it in terms of, let's do this song, let's do Little Red Rooster, I'm a King Bee. Mm-hmm. And so then in the first season of Saturday Night Live, they go on live in these ridiculous bee costumes.
See, that was a conceit in the first season of SNL, and people are not going to remember this at all. Putting the performers in bee outfits and giant bee costumes.
Yeah, it was Lorne kind of torturing them, especially Belushi, because he hated the bee costumes. But they went on, looking angry and saying, "I'm a king bee." In these bee costumes. So that was not the Blues Brothers, but it was like an early iteration of it. And then it kind of goes dormant, I would argue. Although Aykroyd told me that they were always working on it, but you don't see it anywhere for a couple of years. And then this is the important thing, is Belushi goes to Oregon to film Animal House, which was a game changer for his career. It was a huge film and it made him into a huge star. And while he was filming Animal House, he met Curtis Salgado, who was a front man with this band that featured a really talented blues guitarist who was Robert Cray. Belushi and Salgado hung out, and Salgado schooled Belushi on blues, and Belushi came back really fired up about the blues, and that would have been in the 1970 into 1978. And so then he and Aykroyd both were really into the blues, and that was really when the official Blues Brothers characters came together.
When did they start doing the concerts as the Blues Brothers?
Because I'm going to forget some of this.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
So this is important because I
remember
like
my dad having the briefcase full of blues.
I was 10
album.
At this yeah. time. I was 10 yeah. years old, and everybody was watching as these guys who were television comedians suddenly were reinventing themselves in 1978. As like frontmen of this serious band that was going to go on tour and make a record, which was weird. I think it was unprecedented. There was no such thing as like the guys from Welcome Back, Kotter, you know, or from some show you know,
Carol Burnett, Tim Conway, and Harvey Korman did not go out and form
on
a band.
Tour.
Right.
But the big breakout shows were in September of 78, if I'm not mistaken, and they opened for Steve Martin at the Universal Amphitheater in California, and that was where the big number one album was recorded. But it was just, it was weird for all of us who were fans of SNL. Like, why are these guys, is this serious? You know, and finally said, well, I guess we don't care if it's serious. It's good stuff. You know, it was a great band.
Talk about some of the people who were in that band, a lot of whom were the killer axes from Stax and Atlanta and the Muscle Shoals and the crew.
The horns in the Big Blues Brothers band were basically the SNL horns, probably augmented with a couple other, you know, ringers from around New York. And the rhythm section was pretty much the Stax rhythm section, Cropper and Dunn. And then they got this great guitarist, Matt Guitar Murphy, as the nominal lead guitarist. The funny thing about Steve Cropper, as famous as he is, he considers himself a rhythm guitarist. So they had needed a lead, so they got Matt Guitar Murphy. And it was, you know, pound for pound, probably the best rhythm and blues combo in circulation at that point, albeit with a sort of amateur frontman, right? Frontmen.
Brothers by Daniel DeVizet, who's our guest this hour. You talk about that some of the reviews, and you know, as a kid listening to the Briefcase Full of Blues album that my dad had, I didn't pick up on this, but Belushi's singing is not great.
Well,
to put it kindly, a lot of the reviews kind of say that.
It's a have to be there sort of thing. If you see, if you were there to see him perform, by all accounts, he was an amazing frontman.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue he was just a good singer. He would have been a great guy to, like, sing at an open mic night or something, or to front a high school band, which, you know, he kind of did. But, you know, every musician
he's trying really hard.
I interviewed a bunch of the musicians, and they all just thought he was a great front man.
Yeah.
But he was John Belushi. He was super famous. So in the end, none of that really mattered. You know, people wanted to see him and wanted to hear this amazing band that he was fronting. And they did their best to sort of, what's the religious term? Proselytize, I guess, for this music, you know, to go out there and tell people about this great music that they love.
Well, that's what happened to me. And I think that's why the book kind of resonated with me. Daniel DeVizet is our guest. The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic. Because I heard that album and it was still getting some radio airplay when I was a kid on the classic rock kind of stations. And it made me want to go out and find the original songs. It made me want to go out and find the John Lee Hooker version or the Little Walter version or the whomever. I think I heard Rubber Biscuit by the Chips on probably the Dr. Demento show and was like, oh, whoa, this is what Dan Aykroyd was doing on the record all of a sudden. Now I know. And that happened to a lot of people, didn't it?
That's what I did after seeing the Blues Brothers. And I probably saw it in the second run theaters where they weren't very strict about letting kids in to R-rated movies. After I saw it a couple times, I did not go and buy the Blues Brothers record. I went and bought The Best of Sam and Dave, and it became probably one of my first rhythm and blues records. I had some, I think I had some Otis Redding, I had a little Aretha Franklin, but Sam and Dave, that was probably one of the first, I don't know, 10 or 20 rhythm and blues records that I owned. It was foundational. And I mean, you could see them plugging it into the player in the car, so obviously they were wanting me to buy it, so I bought it. You know,
it's almost an advertisement for Sam and Dave. Yeah. There's a lot of it's Sam and Dave in that in that movie, and they do focus on right before the police chase that goes through the shopping mall in the movie. And let's get to the production of the movie. They focus on them putting that I think it's an 8-track actually into the 8-track,
either a cassette or an 8-track.
Yeah, I don't remember now. Yeah. I've only seen that movie 1,000 times, and I don't remember. the movie had the potential to be another Heaven's Gate. I mean, there were times when this production had the potential to go off the rails, didn't it? Including from the very beginning when Dan Aykroyd doesn't even have a script. He's got a script treatment, which is kind of like the story that is going to be turned into the script. But what did you say it was going to be, like 8 hours to have to shoot this thing?
The script was... How many pages it was?
300 pages or something, you said.
Is that how long it was? Yeah. It was huge.
Which, if you take a minute a page.
The minute a page, yeah. It would have been like five movies or something. Yeah. And here's the important thing. In Hollywood, would think comedies were generally, at that time, were like 1 million, 2 million. I think, I think Animal House was a couple million, maybe 3 million or something. This was a comedy, but it was also, of course, a musical and also an action film and a car crash thing. I think the studio people were uncomfortable, even with the initial budget, which was probably around 8, 9, 10 million. Even for a Belushi film, and Belushi was huge at that time, and then the budget just ballooned, and Landis had made one big film at that point, that was Animal House, so they had some faith in him, but, you know, everyone other than Landis was basically on coke the whole time, it seemed like.
Boy.
Landis was a teetotaler, but was it Ned Tanen? And I think the big studio exec, it might have been Ned, came and visited, and they were just terrified, and he wanted to see the set, because it was probably a madhouse, and it spawned a bunch of, I printed out all these articles in the LA Times and Variety and stuff, saying this is going to break the bank at Universal.
It's going to ruin Universal Studios.
It's going to ruin more to the point, there was this chagrin at the idea of these kind of dumb movies spending huge amounts of money on a stupid movie. Like it really offended the sensibilities of like the New York Times critics to think that this idiotic sophomoric film becomes a $20 million film. It's just ridiculous to them. It's funny because now you've got these, like, how many millions of dollars are spent on these superhero films now? It makes what Landis did look like child's play.
Even the Naked Gun reboot that Liam Neeson and Pamela Anderson in is probably anything that John Landis could have imagined.
Could have ever conceived, yeah.
Radio 9! Have you ever heard of a wish sandwich? A wish sandwich is the kind of a sandwich where you have two slices of bread and you wish you had some meat. Ball, ball, ball.
Address the drug use briefly, because unfortunately, especially for Gen X, I think that's probably a lot of what Belushi is remembered for. Was this when Belushi's substance abuse problem really got out of hand, was filming this movie?
One of the SNL guys, it might have been, I'm not going to remember who, but one of the writers made a really good point, which is that to track a Belushi's substance problems, or anyone's from that era, all that you really need to do is follow the money. The more money Belushi earned, the more he was capable of buying and using cocaine, which of course was much, much more dangerous for him than weed or beer or whatever. I mean, they're all dangerous in one way or another, but cocaine, of course, is deadly, deadly. And he couldn't really use lots and lots of it until he had the money to use lots of it, which would have been probably around as soon as Animal House
comes out.
After
he got that big payment from Animal House,
he starts getting bigger and bigger checks, and it became harder and harder for poor Judy to control him or his substance use. He'd be out in the limousine all night, and at a certain point, it's like, hey, it's Bluto, and people would just start giving him powder.
You point out that Judy Jacklin Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and others, Bernie Brillstein, around Belushi, you know, assigned minders to him to follow him around, basically bouncers to keep people away from him.
Yeah.
And as you said, there was money to be made, and people are going to find their way around those minders.
There were periods there where Smokey Wendell, he's a guy who's now, I think, attached to the Eagles, like permanently as their guy. But he very successfully blocked Belushi from getting any product, any of the snow powder, for a while. So there were periods of a few months here and there near the end when Belushi was relatively clean. But in the end, you know, if you're an addict, you're either going to find what you're addicted to, or you go into a program and, you know, and kick it. And unfortunately, he never, there was never a successful intervention with Belushi.
You mentioned too, the Carrie Fisher romance. You go into some detail about the Carrie Fisher romance there. Was it true that Belushi is who introduced her to Coke in the first place?
I think he might have also introduced her to whiskey or something. So Belushi wanted Carrie Fisher to be dating Aykroyd because he wanted to kind of go on double dates and wanted Aykroyd to have a girlfriend who was fun. And he probably identified some with Carrie because I think she too had kind of an addictive personality. Yeah. And then there was something where she like choked on a Brussels sprout.
Yeah,
and then
Dan gave her the Heimlich maneuver, I think you said. Yeah.
Yeah, and he proposed marriage, but she thankfully it didn't go through. I think thankfully, because I think it was a very tumultuous time for all parties. Yeah, and then Carrie Fisher, we now know, was apparently on LSD when she was shooting some of the pivotal scenes that she was in the Blues Brothers. And mind you, she's kind of like almost the biggest performer in the film, except for the two of them. It's a two-hander. It's really just Aykroyd and Belushi. But Carrie Fisher was like the third build person. And yeah, she was tripping.
She was tripping the whole time. Daniel DeVizet is our guest for a few more minutes. He's the author of the new book, The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Film Classic. Chicago had a reputation for not wanting movies and TV shows to be filmed there for a long time. And that, considering, is it NBC that has a whole franchise now of Chicago set TV shows, that's kind of surprising.
Yeah,
but what was the deal that Chicago did not want movies and TV shows there?
Mayor Daley, the older Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, in the 50s, unplugged all production, all film, and I think television production in the city because some show had portrayed a cop taking a bribe.
I think it was M-Squad. I think it was Lee Marvin and M-Squad.
Okay,
yeah.
Lee Marvin.
Yeah.
And so there was almost, not zero, but close to zero films made in Chicago for until Daley died or until he was no longer in office, which was a long, long time, way into the 70s, almost the end of the 70s. So the Blues Brothers wound up being almost the first film that was let back in the gate by the new mayor, who was Jane Byrne. And she let them pretty much rampage through the city, closing down entire freeways, which you wouldn't see that now, probably today in a big city.
Talk a little bit about Landis, because he sounds like a wild person in this film, including with the stunts, the famous stunt that's on the end of the expressway where the Nazis are chasing the Blues Brothers. The scene where the car almost goes off the end of the expressway, it did almost go off the end of the expressway.
I should say that whatever standards were in place for safety and filmmaking on the Blues Brothers set would have been probably the exact same standards on probably any film set for a big studio in the late 70s. And Landis, let me say again, was not on anything. He was a teetotaler, very intelligent, very good filmmaker. So I think the standards were the same that you would have had with any, like a Spielberg shoot or what have you. But they were different standards then today. And there is some stuff. The thing that is most chilling to me is probably the stunt woman in the red pantsuit in the Miss Piggy scene in the Toys R Us. If you look and watch that closely, she almost gets clipped by the car in that.
Reception for the film when it finally did come out?
Bad.
Okay.
It was panned by most of the big, you know, the Times, the Post, the LA Times, Time Magazine, the New Yorker. They all panned.
They were also kind of offended by, why did we spend all this money on a comedy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And also they thought it was dumb. They couldn't understand why the main characters are just kind of standing there kind of deadpan the whole time. I mean, I think it was hilariously understated. performances by them, and they wanted the rhythm and blues artists to have kind of center stage and to be remembered. But yeah, there was a lot of misunderstanding, and film critics will tell you, if you find somebody who was a film critic for the Post Gazette or something, they will tell you, film critics since time immemorial have botched their reviews of comedies. They're oftentimes comedies are misunderstood and underappreciated by reviewers. They just don't get them sometimes.
Two critics who did enjoy it were Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert.
In Chicago, and I think because they loved it, that it was a Chicago movie, and they probably got it in ways that other critics didn't. Bear in mind, they were both in their 20s, I'm pretty sure, or if they were 30, they were barely 30.
Young. Yeah.
So they were young and got the humor. They Ebert loved SNL, loved SNL. And both Siskel and Ebert understood, I think, on a sort of cellular level, understood that kind of humor in ways that, like, you know, the much older film reviewer in, like, Wilmington, Delaware, maybe didn't understand, you know?
The Blues Brothers, Daniel DeVizet is the author. An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic. You can get that from Grove Press or bookshop.org or wherever books are sold. I, like a lot of people, I was a little bit young to have seen the movie in the theater originally, but I discovered it, like a lot of people did, on television. How did television give this movie a second life where it became this cult classic now?
It was one of the first films to do as well overseas as domestically. It was widely embraced. I have now a UK version of this book that did well. I have a German version. We're doing the translation right now. Germans love the Blues Brothers. There's an Italian translation. They absolutely adore Landis and the Blues Brothers. They play Trading Places like at New Year or something in Italy. And there's a Spanish language edition. They love the Blues Brothers. It's kind of a universal film.
Because of the music? The music carries the film?
Yeah, definitely. The music, the people in all those countries and in Australia love seeing Aretha Franklin and James Brown, and they love the music. And these are pretty simple characters to understand, right? Jake and Elwood. The funny thing is, if you talk to somebody in Australia or in Lisbon or wherever, they don't know, they don't realize that there were Blues Brothers characters before there was a Blues Brothers film.
Sure.
Outside of the U.S., everybody just assumes the characters were created for the film, which is kind of funny.
And what did the movie then do, as we alluded to at the beginning of our conversation, do for the careers of the artists who were in there, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, and some of the others?
I'm sorry, you were talking about television. It did have a huge second life on video and on television. Yeah. There was a theater in, like, Adelaide, Australia that played it, like, Rocky Horror every weekend for, like, 30 years or something. It has a huge second life in the United States, of course. It's one of those films, right, that dudes especially can quote lines from it. And so, of course, they're going to show it on TV all the time. It's kind of like a Spinal Tap type film,
dudes,
or a Holy Grail.
Not just dudes. One of the things that my wife and I bonded over the disco pants and haircuts. The new Oldsmobiles are here. So, yeah, these very quotable movies.
Very quotable. And yes, you asked about the careers. Ray Charles, I think James Brown, a couple of the marquee stars of that film, you know, went on the record in, like, People magazine or in, like, Rolling Stone saying, yeah, man, this really helped my career, you know. And Aretha's, I think, brother in a biography of her said the same thing, that it really did kick up her career.
Because you mentioned that there was some pushback initially from, they may have been Jet magazine or some of the black press saying, why are we fronting these two white guys when it's all these black artists that they are coasting on their reputations? Yeah.
It was not just them. It was the alternative press in the United States and the Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And even, you know, some of the movie reviews when the film came out made the same point, which is how dare they take these great icons of rhythm and blues music and put them in the service of a film that stars these two goofballs. And, of course, the answer to that is that after Animal House, there was no question that there was going to be another Belushi film because he was huge. And the only question was what the Belushi film was going to be. And in 1978, all Belushi cared about was the Blues Brothers. And so it became a Blues Brothers film. And there was no way that film wasn't going to star Belushi, right? And I think they were kind of embarrassed and ashamed that they were starring in this film. They would have much rather had Aretha and Ray Charles be the stars. And this is why they gave
this. It would have never gotten made.
It wouldn't have gotten made, no. Yeah. And this is why they gave kind of deadpan performances, especially in the musical numbers. They just want to watch their heroes perform. They don't want to be in the scene at all, you know?
Let's go back, let's go way on, way back when. I didn't even know you, you couldn't have been too.
what has caused people to go back and reevaluate this movie as a serious piece of filmmaking and as a landmark comedy movie now?
Over the decades, I think the original Saturday Night Live cast has been enshrined as maybe the greatest group on Saturday Night Live, and the show now is 50 years old, so it has its own thing, its own gravitas as a great work of television. So the Blues Brothers was kind of the first big SNL film, so it has gravitas from that. Landis's films are I think universally recognized. He had this run of amazing films starting with, you know, Kentucky Fried Movie and Animal House, Trading Places, all that. So it endures especially two things. One is it's arguably the greatest Chicago film, even though it was just about the first.
I've seen the Chicago papers have made that point on more than one occasion, that this is probably the best movie ever made in and about Chicago.
The only one to rival it is Ferris Bueller, at least for people of a certain age. Mm-hmm. And then the other point is, as an artifact of these rhythm and blues greats, Aretha, James Brown, and so forth, that's ultimately the reason the film matters.
Still at the height of their powers. Like, no longer in the top 10 R&B artists or whatever, but still very much vital and at the height of their powers. To get to see them on a big screen in full Technicolor is pretty amazing. Final thoughts, Daniel DeVizet, on the Blues Brothers. And, I mean, this is impossible to predict, but 50 years from now, are people still going to be watching this movie like they're still watching the Marx Brothers, or they're still watching W.C. Fields or some others?
Boy, I don't know. I suppose that when all the Gen Xers and the baby boomers die out, maybe some of the adulation for the film will die out too. I mean, I don't think people think about or watch the Marx Brothers now like they did in the 1970s or 1980s. But, you know, this film has been preserved by the Library of Congress, assuming that library still exists. I think it still does. and it's been enshrined on so many lists. I think it'll have some staying power, maybe for the next 50 years. Of course, if you'd ask the Beatles, you know, will you guys be remembered in 50 years? I'm sure they would have said no.
Right.
You know.
But you are on social media at DanielDeVizet.com. And again, the book is available from Grove Press Bookshop or wherever finer books are sold. It's called The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Film Classic. Daniel, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love Pittsburgh. Can't wait to get back there.
And what song would you like me to play here to wrap up our conversation?
Oh, you know, maybe Soothe Me by Sam and Dave.
You got it, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And it comes-